I already was a historian. That is, I had gone through all the professional training of a historian. I had a PhD from Columbia University, and I had never encountered in any of my classes anywhere as an undergraduate or graduate the name of Emma Goldman. Now, that tells you something about historical education in this country. I know everybody complains about historical education, but people complain about it from different points of view. Now, the New York Times, I remember, a few years ago, complained about the historical ignorance of students because they didn't know who was the president during the Mexican War, you know, and didn't know whether the Homestead Act came before the Civil Service Act, you know, and things like that. But, you know, there's another point of view in which people are distressed because our historical education doesn't include people like Emma Goldman or Big Bill Haywood, or only tells about Helen Keller as a sort of a struggling person who overcame handicaps and doesn't tell about her as a socialist and an anti-war, anti-militarist person. So in the 1960s, actually, I must say, reading outside of my formal education, because sometimes you read outside of your classes, which is when you learn the most, and I had come across a book called Critics and Crusaders, which some of you, you know, three of you may know. And Critics and Crusaders, wonderful book. Get it in a library, but it has chapters on a lot of people that never appear in history books, but are some of the great people of American history. And there I had read a chapter on Emma Goldman, but then put it somewhere in the back of my mind. Then in the 1960s, I went to some conference in Pennsylvania on violence, and there encountered another historian, and historians asked one another, to let you in on how historians speak to one another, ask one another, what have you done? You know, what have you written? Which means, what have you written? This was Richard Drennan I ran into, and he said, oh, I've written this biography of Emma Goldman. So after the conference, I went to get the biography, because you always want to read books by people that you've met. So when somebody catches you reading it, you say, oh, I know this person. I read this really wonderful biography of Emma Goldman, Living My Life. No, I'm sorry, Rebel in Paradise. Rebel in Paradise by Richard Drennan, which still remains as one of the, you know, really fine biography, and was a pioneering thing since most of the work on and by Emma Goldman had been out of print for some time. That led me to Living My Life. And for those of you who haven't read her autobiography, Living My Life, you should immediately go and read it. As big as it is, it will read very fast because it's so interesting. And I even, undaunted by the size of the book, you know, two volumes, or you can sometimes get a very fat one-volume edition, but undaunted by the size of the book, I even, several years, had some of assigned it to my students to read. And it turned out to be sort of one of the all-time hit books for my students to read. I think there were three books of all that I assigned my students to read over the decades. There were three books that were by far the most popular. And one of them was Living My Life by Emma Goldman. The other was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And the third was Dalton Trumbo's novel, Johnny Got His Gun. You can see those aren't traditional text material. But Emma Goldman was not being taught, and so I decided my students had to know something about anarchism and about Emma Goldman and her friends. And when I started to teach at Boston University, I attended one of those, when you start to teach somewhere, they have a reception for new faculty members, which is always very boring. And at this reception for new faculty members, I found myself sipping sherry with another new faculty member who was going to be in, well, what questions you ask, what department will you be in? He's going to be in the philosophy department. What department will I be in? Well, I was going to be in the political science department. Oh, and what is your political philosophy, he asked. Well, you're not supposed to ask that for somebody in the political science department. I never heard of anybody in the political science department who had a political philosophy, you see. It's not professional. But I thought I had to come up with something, so I said, I guess I'm an anarchist. And he looked at me, and he said, that's impossible. Anyway, so anarchism is still not taught. It's interesting. We'll teach political theory, political philosophy, also long lists of political theorists and anarchists, and anarchism, you know, still doesn't have a recognition as a political philosophy. So it's an important thing for people to look at and for people to read. From living my life, from Emma Goldman's autobiography, I went on to Alexander Berkman's Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist, which has been out of print for a long time, but there's a new sort of edition which has most of it and other Berkman's writings, which is published by a little publishing outfit in Manhattan called Four Walls, Eight Windows. And then what? Oh, and then I was in Amsterdam. And because I was in Amsterdam, I decided to look up the International Institute of Social History, which if you ever go to Amsterdam, and I'm sure all of you will soon go to Amsterdam, you will find in the International Institute of Social History a wonderful collection of documents, material, letters from and to all sorts of people. And you know, they collected stuff from the Nazi archives. That doesn't mean the Nazi. That is from Germany, which the Nazis had secreted away and didn't want anybody to look at, you know, like Karl Marx's early letters. There was no point really secreting them away because nobody could ever read Marx's handwriting. But they had stuff. And then they had this collection of Emma Goldman, of letters to and from Emma Goldman. Now, wonderful collections. I spent days and days and days there in Amsterdam copying pieces of these letters. And then I get home and I find that Richard Drennan has already done that and has published a lot of that. He and his wife, Anna Marie Drennan, published that in a book, which also you should read. I'm telling you all of this. I'm giving you this bibliographical information because I can't. There's not much I can tell you in a short time about the fantastically rich and complex life, and so you know you really have to go and read stuff for yourself. But they publish a book called Nowhere at Home, which are the letters that Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman wrote to one another in exile after you know they. Among those letters that I read at the International Institute of Social History were the letters from Ben Reitman. And as I read them, I'd never come across that before, and as I read those letters, I thought that the International Institute of Social History would be ablaze in 5 minutes from those letters. Well, you have to read those letters. I mean, you can't even call them love letters. I mean, the phrase love letter is a pallid description of the letters that went between Reitman and Goldman. You'll find some of them reproduced in Candace Falk's book. I've been talking to you about this, sort of the older literature, but in the last 2 years there have been a number of books, one of them Candace Falk's books, Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, and she reproduces what's called Love and Anarchy, I think. She reproduces some of the Reitman Goldman letters. What I think I'll do is sort of give you. I'm looking at you and trying to figure out by looking at you how much do you know about Emma Goldman, and it's very hard to tell. So, but I will give you a quick rundown of her life. I don't see how I can, but I will give you a sort of quick summary of her life, and then go into what I think, talk about some of her ideas, which to me is most important. That is, her life is, of course, fascinating, and history is interesting, but I've never been a historian who sort of went into the past and got lost in it, which is a common thing. Because it's so interesting. You go in, and you get lost. You don't want to come out. It's fascinating. But I believe that, I always believe you should go in, and as tempting as it is to stay, come out, and bring some of that stuff with you and apply it to what's going on today and make some connection between what has happened in the past and what is going on today. So, in that sense, her ideas, transcend the period in which he lived and connect, I think, very closely and very importantly with the kind of things that are still going on today. But she was born in Lithuania, a little town in Lithuania, which is then part of Russia, Kovno, and she grew up in poor circumstances in a Jewish family and worked in factories at an early age and spent some time in Königsberg with an aunt and some time in St. Petersburg and had sort of exhilarating experiences of going to the opera for the first time and being excited by the music about 16 when the family emigrated to the United States and moved to Rochester, New York. And there in Rochester, this little immigrant Jewish family lived the way immigrants without much money lived. And Emma worked in a factory, and she, at an early age, she married some guy. That's the way to put it. It was some guy that she married, and which, didn't work out very quickly, and while she was there in Rochester, she began to make sort of emotional contact with the things that were swirling around in the United States. You have to understand that this is a time, in the 1880s, mid 1880s, this is the time when class conflict in the United States is at a very intense point. Now, that period roughly between 1877 and 1914, the period of, which is described in history books as the period of the Industrial Revolution, the period when the United States became a great industrial power, and it's described as a period, it's described exultantly as that time when the United States became this powerful economic force. But it wasn't an exultant time for the people who worked down in the depths of that Industrial Revolution, and the people who worked in Carnegie steel mills or, Rockefeller's oil fields or worked on the railroads and who died by the thousands building a transcontinental railroad, and the girls went to work in the textile mills and died at the age of 25. And it was a period when all of that was
crystallizing in battle for the eight-hour day, and battle for lunch hours, battle for against kids working at the age of 8 and 9 and 10. Here's a sort of a typical news item from that day. Sometimes I find things when I'm looking for them. But this is Trenton, New Jersey. 300 girl strikers of the American Cigar Company. They stopped work went on strike because they wanted an hour for lunch. They were working 14 hours a day, and they thought that instead of having a half hour for lunch, they should have an hour for lunch. So 3,000 girl strikers, as they put it, and they were girls, they were young, attacked the factory, the American Cigar Company, with stones and sticks, smashed the windows, demand a full hour. They're led by a 16-year-old girl named Sally Carr. Another headline from that era, millionaires living in fear and trembling. Jay Gould, some of you have heard of Jay Gould. How can I describe him? Take all the crooked Wall Street financiers of our time and wrap them up into one. That's Jay Gould, you know. It says, Jay Gould's habits altered due to the fact that there was an explosion at Russell Sage's office, an attempt on Russell Sage's life, so Jay Gould has altered his habits. And they had an interview with Cornelius Vanderbilt's bodyguard. The headline is, Cornelius Vanderbilt not afraid, but his friends are. Anyway, those are the kind of things. I mean, there's a time of strikes, the great railroad strikes of 1877. And in 1886, one of the important events in American history takes place in Chicago, the Haymarket Affair. And, again, I don't know. How many of you have heard of the Haymarket Affair? Oh, this is a very well-educated audience. You've probably heard of everything I'm telling you. And what's the point of all this? You see, but anyway, the Haymarket, well, for those three of you who don't know, we always hope there are three people in the audience who don't know what we're talking about. The Haymarket Affair came out of the struggle for the eight-hour day, and there was a strike at the International Harvester plant in Chicago, and the police attacked the strikers and killed a number of strikers, not an uncommon occurrence in those days, and the anarchist movement of Chicago, and there was a strong anarchist movement of Chicago. Well, as you know, it's the radicals who take the first steps, the anarchists, the Trotskyists, the communists, the socialists. You know, they're always first, you know. And the anarchists, you know, call a meeting, or mass rally, protest. The rally takes place in Chicago, not quite at Haymarket Square, but near it. And but it becomes known as Haymarket Affair. And while the rally is going on and somebody is speaking from the platform, one of the anarchist leaders of Chicago, in fact, is speaking from the platform. It's a peaceful meeting. It's attacked by the police. The police charge into the meeting with their clubs flailing, and then a bomb explodes in the middle of the police, and a bunch of policemen are killed. Nobody knows who threw the bomb. Nobody to this day knows. You know, they're still, you know, one of those things that they're always trying to puzzle. That's no problem for the police. If there's no evidence on who threw the bomb, what do? You arrest the eight leading anarchists in Chicago, because they must be behind it, whoever threw the bomb. That is a common logic for arresting radicals. Something took place. Here are the radicals. The radicals must be behind it. So they arrest 8 leading radicals and put them on trial for conspiracy to murder, and they are sentenced to death. And rouses international cry and defense all over the country, and the George Bernard Shaw sends a cable from England saying, because the matter is now up before the Illinois Supreme Court, and the Illinois Supreme Court turns down the plea of the 8 anarchists, and George Bernard Shaw sends a telegram. He says, if America must lose 8 of its population, it could better afford to lose the 8 members of the Illinois Supreme Court than the 8 anarchists who are sentenced to death. But anyway, 4 of them were executed, and their execution had one of those effects, one of those cataclysmic effects that certain events in American history have on the consciousness of young people growing up in the society. Things like the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, or the execution of the Rosenbergs, and the execution of the 4 leaders of anarchist leaders had that kind of effect on Emma Goldman. She describes in her autobiography what happens when a visitor comes to her family home, and she's having enough troubles with her father anyway. And this visitor and her father sort of gloat over the execution of these radicals, and Emma Goldman picks up a pitcher of water and throws it into this visitor's face to show him how she feels. And she believed in direct action. And that was her slogan. She left home soon after and went to New York. In New York, she took up with, I usually wondered about that phrase, took up with this little bunch of New York radicals, anarchists, who would gather in Saks Cafe on Suffolk Street in downtown Manhattan, and they were all working people, and they talked about, they gather there after work and talk about revolution and what to do, and discuss Marx and Kropotkin and have arguments between the Marxists and the anarchists, and there she met Alexander Berkman, who was a few years younger than her, an impassioned anarchist. And they became lovers and comrades and friends, and then they were joined by a few other friends, and they formed a little commune, and one of them, including an artist, a friend of theirs, with whom Emma also became lovers. And I tell you this just to give you a little hint of the kind of life that she led, and a free life, and this is what she believed in. And she and Berkman both proclaimed their belief in the freedom of people to love whoever they wanted, unrestrained by the laws of society or the traditions of monogamy and so on. And in 1892, when there was a strike at Homestead, Pennsylvania, a steel plant belonging to Andrew Carnegie, and the Carnegie Corporation and Henry Clay Frick managing it called out the Pinkerton Detective Agency to break the strike, and the Pinkertons moved into the area, and there was a gun battle, and a number of the strikers were killed, and then Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and a few of their friends getting together in Worcester in the ice cream parlor, which they now owned. Anarchists were always figuring out ways to make money. Not a lot of money, just a little money, just survival money, just enough money to put out a magazine, enough money to maybe to escape the factory and so on. So this ice cream store in Worcester was one of their things, and so they heard about what had happened in Homestead, Pennsylvania, and decided we have to do something now, which, well, they do it in Europe. They assassinate czars and chiefs of police and people who symbolize the terror regimes. And now we're going to do this in the United States. We're going to kill Henry Clay Frick. You know, they were 20, 21 years old. And Berkman sets out to do this, and they get him a suit. Because you can't, you know, when you kill somebody, you can't look bad. They get him a new suit, and they get him a gun, and a train ticket to Pittsburgh, and he gets into Henry Clay Frick's office. He was a very good anarchist, a very poor assassin. And he fired away and missed, and, you know, and, anyway, he was then sort of knocked unconscious and then put on trial and sentenced to 22 years in prison for attempted murder. As usual, people usually jailed for attempted murder did not get 22 years in prison, but an anarchist who is, and this is still the case today, that is, political criminals who have committed the same acts that other people have committed who are not political people, the political criminals who get sentences twice or three times as big. Just that's the way the system works. And Berkman goes to prison, actually spends 14 years in prison. During this period, Emma Goldman becomes a speaker, a leader, a strike leader. I didn't say anything about her relationship with Johann Most, who is an anarchist leader from Germany, who was a very important figure in the anarchist movement, and who's kind of helped her as she began to go out and speak and develop her abilities. But she was way beyond him in certain ways very, very soon. But she, as I say, she began to speak, began to, very soon, this was 1893, the country's in an economic crisis in 1893, huge numbers of people unemployed, and addresses a great meeting in Union Square, urges people who don't have food for their kids to go into the stores and take it. Another form of direct action. And anarchists, I mean, it's part of the anarchist philosophy. If people are starving, you don't write a letter to your congressman asking that legislation be introduced so that someday people may have enough food. The idea of direct action is that if people don't have enough food, you take it. Laws or no laws. You do what is necessary immediately and directly to give people what they deserve and what they need. You can't let children starve waiting for the election of the next president. This was that philosophy. She was arrested for that, sentenced to jail, spent a year in jail on Blackwell's Island. While she was on Blackwell's Island, she encountered a prison nurse who taught her something about nursing. After she came out, she went to Europe, studied to be a midwife. And there in Europe also she met anarchist leaders, met Kropotkin, the grand old man of anarchism, and met Malatesta, the Italian anarchist, and met Louise Michel, the heroine of the 1871 Paris Commune. I mean, her life was filled with, you know, encounters with these remarkable people who affected her and were always affected by her. And she he came back to the United States and continued to speak out wherever she could, spoke on birth control. Well, that was a dangerous thing to do. And the police followed her everywhere, and she was arrested again and again. And the detectives and plainclothes people went everywhere she spoke. And one time, however, they failed to arrest her after a speech on birth control because she had spoken to, in the sort of Lower East Side of New York, to a group of Jewish women. And the detective who attended the meeting sent a report back to superiors saying that he didn't have enough evidence to arrest her because she spoke to them in Yiddish. And he wasn't that well equipped. There weren't a lot of Jewish detectives, as you might imagine. In 1901, she became really notorious because that was the year that President McKinley was assassinated. And assassinated by a man named Leon Czolgosz, who was, I don't know how to describe him. He was a marginal person, a person like a lot of the people who commit assassinations. And a person who had sometimes hung around anarchist meetings, and apparently in some of the interrogations of the police had uttered the name of Emma Goldman. Immediately a hunt on for Emma Goldman. She must be behind the assassination. She went into hiding, but finally they got her and arrested her. Didn't keep her very long. There's really no evidence against her. Sometimes it doesn't stop the police, but this time there was really nothing, and so she was released. Czolgosz was executed. His head was severed from his body so that they could examine his brain to see what it was in his brain that caused him to assassinate McKinley. Emma Goldman said they should examine the conditions of American society to see what it was. Because the conditions of American society were enough to cause anybody to become an assassin, even though she didn't believe in assassination. She did not believe that Czolgosz had done the right thing. She didn't, although she had been involved in the attempt to assassinate Frick, she did not really believe anymore in that assassination was a tactic, a proper tactic for a revolutionary movement. However, and in this she got into some conflict with her fellow anarchists who rushed to disavow Czolgosz, you know, this crazy guy who did this violent thing, and we don't want to be associated with that. They already think all anarchists are assassins and bomb throwers. We don't want to have anything to do with this guy. And Emma Goldman said, no. Sure, I'm opposed to his act. It was wrong. It was a stupid thing to do. But I'm not going to try to separate myself from him. I'm going to try to point out to people what it was that led him to do this. I'm going to emphasize that. She was always that way. Independent in her thinking, and always thinking in a very feeling way about of people who did desperate things and things that she very often deprecated, but the causes of which she thought should be understood. Berkman came out of prison in 1906 after those 14 years, and it was a very, very emotional reunion with him and his anarchist friends, and he and Emma Goldman were no longer lovers after this, but they remained friends for the rest of their lives. One of the most remarkable examples of a long and intense friendship, real friendship between a man and a woman, even without a sexual encounter, and in fact, 2 years after Berkman came out. She and Berkman were involved in publishing an anarchist magazine, Mother Earth. And 2 years after that, she met Ben Reitman. How many of you know about her relationship with Ben Reitman? 10 people. Well, finally, I have a chance. Ben Reitman. She was doing a lecture in Chicago. She was going all around the country lecturing. And she was doing a lecture in Chicago, and as usual, the police were not letting her speak and were closing meeting halls. And she was a notorious, outrageous woman, speaking about birth control, speaking about free love, saying that marriage and love had nothing in common. That marriage was an insurance contract. Marriage was an economic arrangement. Love was something else, you see. Even in 1993, there are people who would be outraged by this, right? Family values and all of that, you see. But imagine, in the early 1900s, speaking sometimes in churches about free love. The minister did not know what he was getting into. I don't know why. Or maybe he did. Didn't last long as a minister, probably, after that. But so she's speaking in Chicago, but they're closing the halls to her. And see if I can... The Chicago Tribune reports that how the police, when she starts to speak, drag her off the stage. This is a very common thing with her. She was constantly being dragged off the stage by the police. After being warned that she must not speak, she goes ahead and speaks, and they drag her off the stage and arrest her. And this reporter records this conversation. The police captain, "Thought you'd come here and make trouble, eh?" said the captain. "Behave yourself," Emma shot back. "Talk like a man, even if you are a policeman." The police chief, "You can't talk here." "I'll talk when I damn please." Anyway, tells you something about her, the kind of person she is, right? Not exactly a shy and retiring person. But in Chicago, Ben Reitman finds a place for her to speak. He is called the King of the Hobos. He is this character, this wild, crazy character, who is a doctor, sort of. He is a doctor. Yes, he went to medical school in some strange way. He was working as a janitor in the medical school, and the guy who was supposed to give a medical lecture one day did not show up, and Reitman puts down his tools, janitor tools, and gets up there and delivers the lecture. Tells you something about the state of medical science, I guess. And then he goes to, he somehow gets, Wangle gets money, goes to medical school, becomes a doctor, but not an ordinary doctor, a street corner, a street front, storefront doctor, He takes care of prostitutes and hobos, people without money. He gives gynecological information to, birth control information to women. He does things that doctors don't do, and he's a flamboyant character, and he goes around with a cowboy hat. And I should read to you Emma Goldman's description of him, from as she encounters him. He arrived in the afternoon, an exotic, picturesque figure with a large black cowboy hat, flowing silk tie, and huge cane. His voice was deep, soft, and ingratiating. He was a tall man with a finely shaped head covered with a mass of curly black hair, which evidently had not been washed for some time. His eyes were brown, large, and dreamy. His lips, disclosing beautiful teeth when he smiled, were full and passionate. He looked a handsome brute. I could not take my eyes off his hands. He describes her in his book, his unpublished autobiography called Following the Monkey. Don't ask me. How shall I describe Emma Goldman? I have seen fully 500 writers attempt to do it. She was short, about 5 feet, and weighed about 140 pounds. She had a powerful face, beautiful, strong, clear blue eyes, a nose that was not Jewish. He was an expert on Jewish noses. A nose that was not Jewish, and a strong, firm jaw. She was somewhat nearsighted and wore heavy glasses. Her hair was blonde and silken, and she wore it in a simple knot at the back of her head. Anyway, the electricity between them was indescribable, you see. And there followed this 10-year passionate affair, which, if you read some of their letters, you'll only get an idea of what it was like. But the important thing about it is, maybe it was not the most, well, yes. I was going to say it's not the most important thing to her, to us. The important thing was that, as she put it herself, she was swept up in what became a dependent relationship on a man. This woman of tremendous independence of strength, this woman who spoke out for the equality of women and the independence of women and the strength of women, became dependent on this relationship. And she acknowledged this and understood it, even while she couldn't help herself. And it didn't stop her, and this must be said, it did not stop her from carrying on her political activity. I mean, sometimes it got in the way for a day or two, a night or three, you know. But it didn't stop her from, in fact, Reitman became her lecture organizer. He decided he would come manage her lecture tours around the country. That way they could travel together, and he would be doing something useful. And he believed sort of in the anarchist cause, although her anarchist friends looked on him with horror, you know, because among anarchists, he was an anarchist. You know, he was like, on the spectrum of anarchism, he was off the edge, you see. He was a scoundrel. I mean, he was a scoundrel the way, you know, while he's having this thing with Emma Goldman, women, I mean, you know, all the time. And of course, this led to a lot of trouble and a lot of conflict and a lot of anguish. A very complex guy, a scoundrel, and yet, you know, he was, you know, he had some good values and wanted to do some good things and wanted to help people. But when he went off, as I say, her anarchist friends were horrified when she went off with him, and his hobo friends were scandalized. I don't know if I have this. One of them, one of them I think called Cincinnati Fats, denounced Reitman for going off with Emma Goldman and staying there in Chicago, you know, with his hobo friends. Well, that went on for, as I say, for 10 years. It's sort of crystallized the problem, and Emma Goldman talked about it a lot afterward, the problem that women faced in wanting intimate relationships and yet not wanting to be enslaved by them. But she always insisted that in any conflict between the two, her political passions came first, even though temporarily she would be absolutely overwhelmed. And in fact, in 1917, when the World War One became the issue for the United States, the entrance into the war, and the conscription law was passed, and Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman became opponents and formed a No Conscription League, and had mass meetings against the war and against conscription, and Reitzman felt this was going too far, that this was not a safe thing to do. They would end up in jail. They would end up sort of helpless to do anything. That the prudent thing was to keep quiet at this point and wait for the right moment. And so they parted politically and personally at this time. She and Berkman were both arrested for speaking out against the war, for violating the Conscription Act. The charge against them was conspiring to organize resistance to the draft. I wonder if I, well, her, I want to give you a little of her, part of her speech to the jury. They've been arrested, you know, by a whole sort of army of federal agents going into the offices of Mother Earth and smashing everything to bits. This is what they do always, you know, these police, these federal agents. It doesn't matter. You don't have to resist them. You could be, you know, there quiet as a mouse and timid and waiting to be arrested. They just like to smash everything in sight just to show their, you know, power. And as they're coming in, she asks, "Will you invade the offices of Rockefeller without a search warrant? Is there equal justice before the law in America?" Well, they put her on trial. She speaks to the jury. She says, "You charge us with conspiring as if it were a secret plot to do what we've been doing openly for most of our lives, campaigning against war, militarism, conscription. We say that if America entered the war to make the world safe for democracy, she must first make democracy safe in America. Verily, poor as we are in democracy, how can we give of it to the world? We further say that democracy conceived in the military servitude of the masses and their economic enslavement and nurtured in their tears and blood is not democracy at all. It is despotism, the cumulative result of a chain of abuses which, according to that dangerous document, the Declaration of Independence, the people have a right to overthrow. Gentlemen of the jury, whatever your verdict will be..." By the way, they were gentlemen of the jury. They weren't women of the jury. Gentle there. "Whatever your verdict will be, as far as we are concerned, nothing will be changed. I have publicly held my ideas for 27 years. Nothing on earth would ever make me change my ideas, except one thing, and that is if you will prove to me that our position is wrong, untenable, or lacking in historic fact. But never would I change my ideas because I am found guilty." So, they were sent to prison. She and Berkman spent 2 years in prison from 1917 to 1919. Emma Goldman in prison, she had a remarkable effect on other prisoners. They looked upon her as a leader, a mother. She took care of them. She nurtured them. She was a nurse. But aside from that, she was just a person who cared for all the human beings that she encountered in prison. Berkman went to Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, where he served what prisoners call hard time, punished again and again, put in solitary again and again. And if you want to get an idea of what he suffered in Western Pennsylvania State Penitentiary in those 14 years, which almost drove him to suicide, which drove many of his fellow prisoners to suicide, you'd have to read a prison memoirs of an anarchist. But in 1919, they came out of prison with deportation proceedings against them to send them back to Russia. And J. Edgar Hoover appeared at their deportation proceedings he's been there a long time. J. Edgar Hoover taking a hand in their deportation proceedings. I referred to them as two of the most dangerous people in America. And so they and other people picked up in the Palmer raids, you know, the sweeping of radicals and socialists and the labor organizers without trial or anything, hearings or anything, put them on a ship, send them across the ocean, and so they were sent back to Russia. They'd come from Tsarist Russia, but they were sent back to what was now in 1919 Soviet Russia. And this becomes all of this, of course, is a whole new phase of their lives. And I can see already that I'm never going to get to all the things I want to talk about, but that's okay. You can read. They arrive in the Soviet Union, fresh from with a revolution, and in they're happy that a revolution took place in the Soviet Union, in Russia, right? Happy that the Tsarist regime is overthrown, but not happy with Bolshevik power, not happy with what they see as the increasing repression of the Bolshevik government, not just against capitalists and bourgeois, but against other radicals, against anarchists, against people who protest against Soviet policies, criticize Soviet policies. They meet Lenin, they meet Trotsky, they meet Maxim Gorky. Gorky is putting out a little newspaper, Novaya Vremya. It's a newspaper in which Gorky criticizes the Bolshevik regime for sending troops against dissidents the way the Tsarist regime did. I think the final blow to them is the rebellion of the Kronstadt sailors just outside of Petrograd, which is crushed by Lenin and Trotsky and the Soviet regime of sailors who were dissatisfied with the conditions and wanted the revolution to do more for them than obviously was going to happen. And so the crushing, this was the end. They left the Soviet Union. They spent the rest of their lives as exiles in Europe, and mostly in France. And Emma Goldman spent most of the remaining years in southern France, actually a nice place on the Mediterranean. Poor, but nice. And Berkman spent some time there, some time outside of Paris. They maintained this correspondence all these years, and you'd have to read this collection of their letters, Nowhere at Home by the Drinnens, the letters that they sent back. I brought it with me to read about 27 of them to you, but I feel that I can't make it. While in exile, they, aside from facing the problem of poverty, how are they going to make money, they wrote, she wrote her autobiography at that time, got a big advance from Alfred Knopf, $7,500, the biggest advance that Knopf had ever given for a manuscript, sight unseen. Berkman wrote, the ABC of Communist Anarchism, which is a very succinct, very clear written account of what anarchist philosophy is. They corresponded with one another about violence, about anarchism, Emma Goldman took a very firm stand against the idea of violence, against revolutionary violence. She thought it was self-defeating, it was the wrong thing, that the more violent a radical movement got, it meant that the less organizing it had done. The more organizing you did, the less violent you you had to be. And they argued about women and men and sexual relations, and Emma insisted that it was different for men and women, and men were cruel and crude in their sexual relations. I don't know how she could possibly say a thing like that, but that that's what she said. She tried to educate Alexander Berkman about these things, and educate a lot of other people, because she carried on correspondence with all sorts of people. And they met in Europe. They met George Bernard Shaw and Bertrand Russell and Rebecca West and Paul Robeson and his wife, Islanda Robeson, all sorts of people, Isadora Duncan, all these people floated in and out of their lives. While they were in exile, they still sort of maintained contact with things going on in America and took up and engaged in campaigns when Sacco and Vanzetti were in prison and facing death. They did whatever they could to raise money for the Sacco and Vanzetti campaign, for Tom Mooney and Billings, the two labor leaders who also were along prison sentences in the United States. They tried to raise money for them. They always engaged in one battle or another, and never stopped. And in 1936, Berkman, sick, killed himself. He always said, as you might say, part of the anarchist philosophy, I'm going to do it myself when I feel like, I'm going to do it when I decide it's time. Emma Goldman lived for four more years until 1940. In the meantime, she was able to come back to the United States briefly when Frances Perkins was Secretary of Labor, first woman cabinet member. Frances Perkins arranged for Emma Goldman to come back for a three-month lecture tour in the United States, in which she lectured on the drama, so long as she would lecture not on politics, but on the drama, which was one of her favorite subjects. And so she lectured on Ibsen and Shaw and Chekhov and so on. But, of course, she got in her political licks while lecturing about these people. And in 1940, while in Toronto, I skipped a lot of her love affairs, including one with, Leon Malmut, whose papers, correspondence with her here in the Schlesinger Library. But in 1940, while in Canada, she got a stroke and she died, and her remains are in the Waldheim. Finally, she was allowed to come back into the United States for good, now that she was dead. He buried her ashes in Waldheim Cemetery, where there are the ashes of a number of anarchist leaders. That's a rough sketch of her life. I haven't even begun to get into so many of her ideas and thinking, but I'll just say this, that what she represents, and I'll leave it to you if you have any questions or comments to give me a chance to say more, but what she represents more than anything else is kind of aside from very powerful idea of direct action, of bypassing all the rigmarole of which not only traditional political organizations engage in, but even some radical political organizations engage in, the traditional rigmarole of politics and voting and elections and representative government and so on. No direct action. For people organizing, people gathering themselves and acting, as her arguments about feminism and voting, voting won't do it. The ballot won't do it. The constitutional laws, that doesn't matter. Women must win their freedom directly in these small spheres in which they live and the actual relations in which they have with the people around them, with the man in the house, with a boss on the job, with a, you know, have to do it yourself directly now. Not going to do it by legislation. But beyond all that, in her ideas, there's just the most important thing is not going to do it by legislation. But beyond all of that, beyond her ideas, there's just the most important thing to me is that ferocious spirit of honest independence, of speaking our mind under any circumstances, not being daunted by who was around or what would happen to her, just speaking what she thought was right and having the faith that if she spoke enough and spoke to enough people that something would happen, that people would be affected in ways that she couldn't even predict and that no one could predict. And in fact, that did happen with her, as it has happened with so many others. And in ways which we can't trace, she's had an effect on untold numbers of people, and her ideas have entered in some way into the consciousness of people who've never heard of her. So it's her legacy is a very powerful one, I think, for us right today. Thank you.